Chapter 5, Life as a Cella. Our day started at midnight at Chakpori. As the midnight trumpet sounded, echoing through the dimly lit corridors, we would roll sleepily off our bed cushions and fumble in the darkness for our robes. We all slept in the nude, the usual system in Tibet where there is no false modesty. With our robes on, off we would go, tucking our belongings into the pouched-up front of our dress. Down the passageways we would clatter, not in a good mood at that hour. Part of our teaching was, it is better to rest with a peaceful mind than to sit like Buddha and pray when angry. My irreverent thought often was, well, why can't we rest with a peaceful mind? This midnight stunt makes me angry. But no one gave me a satisfactory answer, and I had to go with the others into the prayer hall. Here, the innumerable butter lamps struggled to shed their rays of light through the drifting clouds of incense smoke. In the flickering light, with the shifting shadows, the giant sacred figures seemed to become alive, to bow and sway in response to our chants. The hundreds of monks and boys would sit cross-legged on cushions on the floor. All would sit in rows the length of the hall. Each pair or rows would face each other so that the first and second rows would be face to face. The second and third would be back to back, and so on. We would have our chants and sacred songs, which employ special tonal scales, because in the East it is realized that sounds have power. Just as a musical note can shatter a glass, so can a combination of notes build up metaphysical power. There would also be readings from the Kangyur. It was a most impressive sight to see these hundreds of men in blood-red robes and golden stoles, swaying and chanting in unison, with the silver tinkle of little bells and the throbbing of drums. Blue clouds of incense smoke coiled and wreathed about the knees of the gods, and every so often it seemed, in the uncertain light, that one or other of the figures was gazing straight at us. The service would last about an hour, and then we would return to our sleeping cushions until 4 in the morning. Another service would start at about 4:15. At 5, we would have our first meal of sampa and buttered tea. Even at this meal, the reader would be droning out his words, and the disciplinarian would be watchful at his side. At this meal, any special orders or information would be given. It might be that something was wanted from Lhasa, and then at the breakfast meal the names of the monks would be called, those who were going to take or collect the goods. They would also be given special dispensation to be away from the lamasery for such and such a time, and to miss a certain number of services. At 6 o'clock, we would be assembled in our classrooms, ready for the first sessions of our studies. The second of our Tibetan laws was, you shall perform religious observances and study. In my 7-year-old ignorance, I could not understand why we had to obey that law when the fifth law, you shall honor your elders and those of high birth, was flaunted and broken. All my experience had led me to believe that there was something shameful in being of high birth. Certainly I had been victimized for it. It did not occur to me then that it was not the rank of birth that matters, but the character of the person concerned. We attended another service at 9 in the morning, interrupting our studies for about 40 minutes. Quite a welcome break sometimes, but we had to be in class again by 9:45. A different subject was started then, and we had to work at it until 1:00. Still, we were not free to eat. A half-hour service came first, and then we had our buttered tea and sampa. 1 hour of manual labor followed to give us exercise and to teach us humility. I seemed more often than not to collect the messiest of the most unpleasant type of job. 3:00 saw us trooping off for an hour of enforced rest. We were not allowed to talk or move, but just to lie still. This was not a popular time because the hour was too short for a sleep, but too long to stay idle. We could think of much better things to do. At 4, after this rest, we returned to our studies. This was the dread period of the day. 5 hours without a break. 5 hours when we could not leave the room for anything without incurring the severest penalties. Our teachers were quite free with their stout canes, and some of them tackled the punishment of offenders with real enthusiasm. Only the badly pressed or most foolhardy pupils asked to be excused when punishment on one's return was inevitable. Our release came at 9:00, when we had the last meal of the day. Again, this was buttered tea and sampa. Sometimes, only sometimes, we had vegetables. Usually that meant sliced turnips or some very small beans. They were raw, but to hungry boys they were very acceptable. On one unforgettable occasion, when I was 8, we had some pickled walnuts. I was particularly fond of them, having had them often at home. Now, foolishly, I tried to work an exchange with another boy, he to have my spare robe in exchange for his pickled walnuts. The disciplinarian heard, and I was called to the middle of the hall and made to confess my sin. As a punishment for greediness, I had to remain without food or drink for 24 hours. My spare robe was taken from me, as it was said that I had no use for it, having been willing to barter it for that which was not essential. At 9:30, we went to our sleeping cushions, bed to us. No one was late for bed. I thought the long hours would kill me. I thought that I should drop dead at any moment, or that I would fall asleep and never awaken again. At first, I and the other new boys used to hide in corners for a good doze. After quite a short time, I became used to the long hours and took no notice at all of the length of the day. It was just before 6 in the morning when, with the help of the boy who had awakened me, I found myself in front of the Lama Mingyar Dondup's door. Although I had not knocked, he called for me to enter. His room was a very pleasant one, and there were wonderful paintings on the wall, some of them actually painted on the walls, and others painted on silk and hanging. A few small statuettes were on low tables. They were of gods and goddesses, and were made of jade, gold, and cloisonné. A large wheel of life also hung upon the wall. The Lama was sitting in the lotus attitude on his cushion, and before him, on a low table, he had a number of books, one of which he was studying as I entered. "Sit here with me, love," sang. "We have a lot of things to discuss together. But first, an important question to a growing man. Have you had enough to eat and drink?" I assured him that I had. "The Lord Abbot has said that we can work together. We have traced your previous incarnation, and it was a good one. Now we want to redevelop certain powers and abilities you then had. In the space of a very few years, we want you to have more knowledge than a Lama has in a very long life." He paused and looked at me long and hard. His eyes were very piercing. "All men must be free to choose their own path," he continued. "Your way will be hard for 40 years if you take the right path, but it will lead to great benefits in the next life. The wrong path now will give you comforts, softness, and riches in this life, but you will not develop. You and you alone can choose." He stopped and looked at me. "Sir," I replied, "my father told me that if I failed at the Lamasery, I was not to return home. How then would I have softness and comfort if I had no home to which to return? And who would show me the right path if I choose it?" He smiled at me and answered, "Have you already forgotten? We have traced your previous incarnation. If you choose the wrong path, the path of softness, you will be installed in the Lamasery as a living incarnation, and in a very few years you will be an abbot in charge. Your father would not call that failure." Something in the way he spoke made me ask a further question. "Would you consider it a failure?" "Yes," he replied. "Knowing what I know, I would call it a failure." "And who will show me the way?" "I will be your guide if you take the right path, but you are the one to choose. No one can influence your decision." I looked at him, stared at him, and liked what I saw. A big man with keen black eyes, a broad open face, and a high forehead. Yes, I liked what I saw. Although only 7 years of age, I had had a hard life and met many people, and really could judge if a man was good. "Sir," I said, "I would like to be your pupil and take the right path," I added somewhat ruefully, I suppose, "but I still don't like hard work." He laughed, and his laugh was deep and warming. "Love sang, love sang. None of us really like hard work, but few of us are truthful enough to admit it." He looked through his papers. "We shall need to do a little operation to your head soon to force clairvoyance, and then we will speed your studies hypnotically. We are going to take you far in metaphysics as well as in medicine." I felt a bit gloomy. More hard work. It seemed to me that I had had to work hard all my 7 years, and there seemed to be little play or kite flying. The Lama seemed to know my thoughts. "Oh, yes, young man, there will be much kite flying later, the real thing, man-lifters. But first, we must map out how best to arrange these studies. He turned to his papers and riffled through them. Let me see, 9 o'clock until 1. Yes, that will do for a start. Come here every day at 9 instead of attending service, and we will see what interesting things we can discuss. Starting from tomorrow, have you any message for your father and mother? I'm seeing them today, giving them your pigtail. I was quite overcome. When a boy was accepted by a lamasery, his pigtail was cut off and his head shaved. The pigtail would be sent to the parents, carried by a small acolyte as a symbol that their son had been accepted. Now, the lama, Mingyar donned up, was taking my pigtail to deliver in person. That meant he had accepted me as his own personal charge, as his spiritual son. This lama was a very important man, a very clever man, one who had a most enviable reputation throughout Tibet. I knew that I could not fail under such a man. That morning, back in the classroom, I was a most inattentive pupil. My thoughts were elsewhere, and the teacher had ample time and opportunity to satisfy his joy in punishing at least one small boy. It all seemed very hard, the severity of the teachers, but then, I consoled myself, that is why I came, to learn. That is why I reincarnated, although then I did not remember what it was that I had to relearn. We firmly believe in reincarnation in Tibet. We believe that when one reaches a certain advanced stage of evolution, one can choose to go on to another plane of existence or return to Earth to learn something more or to help others. It may be that a wise man had a certain mission in life, but died before he could complete his work. In that case, so we believe, he can return to complete his task, providing that the result will be of benefit to others. Very few people could have their previous incarnations traced back. There had to be certain signs, and the cost and time would prohibit it. Those who had those signs, as I had, were termed living incarnations. They were subjected to the sternest of stern treatment when they were young, as I had been, but became objects of reverence when they became older. In my case, I was going to have special treatment to force-feed my occult knowledge. Why, I did not know then. A rain of blows on my shoulders brought me back to the reality of the classroom with a violent jerk. Fool, dolt, imbecile, have the mind demons penetrated your thick skull? It is more than I could do. You are fortunate that it is now time to attend service. With that remark, the enraged teacher gave me a final hearty blow for good measure and stalked out of the room. The boy next to me said, "Don't forget, it's our turn to work in the kitchen this afternoon. Hope we will get a chance to fill our sampa bags." Kitchen work was hard. The regulars there used to treat us boys as slaves. There was no hour of rest for us after kitchen hour. 2 solid hours of hard labor, then straight to the classroom again. Sometimes we would be kept later in the kitchens and so be late for class. A fuming teacher would be waiting for us and would lay about him with his stick without giving us any opportunity of explaining the reason. My first day of work in the kitchen was nearly my last. We trooped reluctantly along the stone-flagged corridors towards the kitchens. At the door, we were met by an angry monk. "Come on, you lazy, useless rascals," he shouted. "The first 10 of you, get in there and stoke the fires." I was the 10th. Down another flight of steps we went. The heat was overpowering. In front of us, we saw a ruddy light, the light of roaring fires. Huge piles of yak dung lay about. This was the fuel for the furnaces. "Get those iron scoops and stoke for your lives," the monk in charge yelled. I was just a poor 7-year-old among the others of my class, among whom was none younger than 17. I could barely lift the scoop, and in straining to put the fuel in the fire, I tipped it over the monk's feet. With a roar of rage, he seized me by the throat, swung me round, and tripped. I was sent flying backwards. A terrible pain shot through me, and there was the sickening smell of burning flesh. I had fallen against the red-hot end of a bar protruding from the furnace. I fell with a scream to the floor among the hot ashes. At the top of my left leg, almost at the leg joint, the bar had burned its way in until stopped by the bone. I still have the dead white scar, which even now causes me some trouble. By this scar, I was in later years to be identified by the Japanese. There was uproar. Monks came rushing from everywhere. I was still among the hot ashes, but was soon lifted out. Quite a lot of my body had superficial burns, but the leg burn really was serious. Quickly, I was carried upstairs to a lama. He was a medical lama, and applied himself to the task of saving my leg. The iron had been rusty, and when it entered my leg, flakes of rust had remained behind. He had to probe around and scoop out the pieces until the wound was clean. Then it was tightly packed with a powdered herb compress. The rest of my body was dabbed with an herbal lotion, which certainly eased the pain of the fire. My leg was throbbing and throbbing, and I was sure that I would never walk again. When he had finished, the lama called a monk to carry me to a small side room, where I was put to bed on cushions. An old monk came in and sat on the floor beside me and started muttering prayers over me. I thought to myself that it was a fine thing to offer prayers for my safety after the accident had happened. I also decided to lead a good life, as I now had personal experience of what it felt like when the fire devils tormented me. I thought of a picture I had seen in which a devil was prodding an unfortunate victim in much the same place as I had been burned. It may be thought that monks were terrible people, not at all what one would expect. But monks, what does it mean? We understand that word as anyone, male living in the monastic service. Not necessarily a religious person. In Tibet, almost anyone can become a monk. Often a boy is sent to be a monk without having any choice at all in the matter. Or a man may decide that he's had enough of sheep herding and wants to be sure of a roof over his head when the temperature is 40 below zero. He becomes a monk not through religious convictions, but for his own creature comfort. The lamasery had monks as their domestic staff, as their builders, laborers, and scavengers. In other parts of the world, they would be termed servants or the equivalent. Most of them had had a hard time. Life at 12 to 20,000 feet can be difficult, and often they were hard on us boys just for sheer want of thought or feeling. To us, the term monk was synonymous with man. We named the members of the priesthood quite differently. A chela was a boy pupil, a novice, or an acolyte. Nearest to what the average man means by monk is trappa. He is the most numerous of those in a lamasery. Then we come to that most abused term, a lama. If the trappas are the non-commissioned soldiers, then the lama is the commissioned officer. Judging by the way most people in the West talk or write, there are more officers than men. Lamas are masters, gurus as we term them. The Lama Mingyar Dondup was going to be my guru and I his chela. After the lamas, there were the abbots. Not all of them were in charge of lamasaries. Many were engaged in the general duties of senior administration or traveling from lamasary to lamasary. In some instances, a particular lama could be of higher status than an abbot. It depended upon what he was doing. Those who were living incarnations, such as I had been proved, could be made abbots at the age of 14. It depended upon whether they could pass the severe examinations. These groups were strict and stern, but they were not cruel. They were at all times just. A further example of monks can be seen in the term police monks. Their sole purpose was to keep order. They were not concerned with the temple ceremonial, except that they had to be present to make sure that everything was orderly. The police monks were often cruel, and as stated, so were the domestic staff. One could not condemn a bishop because his undergardener misbehaved, nor expect the undergardener to be a saint just because he worked for a bishop. In the lamasery, we had a prison, not by any means a pleasant place to be, but the characters of those who were consigned to it were not pleasant either. My solitary experience of it was when I had to treat a prisoner who had been taken ill. It was when I was almost ready to leave the lamasery that I was called to the prison cell. Out in the back courtyard, there were a number of circular parapets about 3 feet high. The massive stones forming them were as wide as they were high. Covering the tops were stone bars, each as thick as a man's thigh. They covered a circular opening about 9 feet across. 4 police monks grasped the center bar and dragged it aside. One stooped and picked up a yak hair rope, at the end of which there was a flimsy-looking loop. I looked on, unhappily. Trust myself to that? Now, honorable medical lama, if you will step here and put your foot in this, we will lower you, said the man. Gloomily, I complied. You will want a light, sir, the police monk said, and passed me a flaring torch made of yarn, soaked in butter. My gloom increased. I had to hold on to the rope, hold on to the torch, and avoid setting myself on fire or burning through the thin little rope which so dubiously supported me. But down I went, 25 or 30 feet, down between walls glistening with water, down to the filthy stone floor. By the light of the torch, I saw an evil-looking wretch crouched against the wall. Just one look was enough. There was no aura around him, so no life. I said a prayer for the soul wandering between the planes of existence and closed the wild, staring eyes, then called to be pulled up. My work was finished now. The body breakers would take over. I asked what had been his crime and was told that he had been a wandering beggar who had come to the lamasery for food and shelter and then, in the night, killed a monk for his few possessions. He had been overtaken while escaping and brought back to the scene of his crimes. But all that is somewhat of a digression from the incident of my first attempt at kitchen work. The effects of the cooling lotions were wearing off, and I felt as if the skin were being scorched off my body. The throbbing in my leg increased. It seemed as if it were going to explode. To my fevered imagination, the hole was filled with a flaming torch. Time dragged. Throughout the lamasery there were sounds, some that I knew and many that I did not. The pain was sweeping up my body in great fiery gouts. I lay on my face, but the front of my body also was burned by the hot ashes. There was a faint rustle, and someone sat beside me. A kind, compassionate voice, the voice of the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, said, "Little friend, it is too much. Sleep." Gentle fingers swept along my spine, again and again, and I knew no more. A pale sun was shining in my eyes. I blinked awake, and with the first returning consciousness, thought that someone was kicking me, that I had overslept. I tried to jump up to attend service, but fell back in agony. My leg! A soothing voice spoke. "Keep still," Lob sang. "This is a day of rest for you." I turned my head stiffly and saw with great astonishment that I was in the Lama's room and that he was sitting beside me. He saw my look and smiled. And why the amazement? Is it not right that two friends should be together when one is sick? My somewhat faint reply was, "But you are a head lama, and I am just a boy." Lob sang, "We have gone far together in other lives. In this, yet, you do not remember. I do. We were very close together in our last incarnations. But now, you must rest and regain your strength. We are going to save your leg for you, so do not worry." I thought of the wheel of existence. I thought of the injunction in our Buddhist scriptures, which says, "The prosperity of the generous man never fails, while the miser finds no comforter. Let the powerful man be generous to the suppliant. Let him look down the long path of lives, for riches revolve like the wheels of a cart. They come now to one and now to another. The beggar today is a prince tomorrow, and the prince may become as a beggar." It was obvious to me even then that the Lama, who was now my guide, was indeed a good man, and one whom I would follow to the utmost of my ability. It was clear that he knew a very great deal about me, far more than I knew myself. I was looking forward to studying with him, and I resolved that no one should have a better pupil. There was, as I could plainly feel, a very strong affinity between us, and I marveled at the workings of fate which had placed me in his care. I turned my head to look out the window. My bed cushions had been placed on a table so that I could see out. It seemed very strange to be resting off the floor some 4 feet in the air. My childish fancy likened it to a bird roosting in a tree, but there was much to see. Far away, over the lower roofs beneath the window, I could see Lassa sprawled in the sunlight, little houses dwarfed by the distance, and all of delicate pastel shades. The meandering waters of the Key River flowed through the level valley, flanked by the greenest of green grass. In the distance, the mountains were purple, surmounted with white caps of shining snow, and nearer mountain sides were speckled with golden-roofed lamassaries. To the left was the Potala, with its immense bulk forming a small mountain. Slightly to the right of us was a small wood from which peeped temples and colleges. This was the home of the state oracle of Tibet, an important gentleman whose sole task in life is to connect the material world with the immaterial. Below, in the forecourt, monks of all ranks were passing to and fro. Some wore a somber brown robe. These were the worker monks. A small group of boys were wearing white, student monks from some distant lamassery. Higher ranks were there too, those in blood red and those with purple robes. These latter often had golden stoles upon them, indicating that they were connected with the higher administration. A number were on horses or ponies. The laity rode colored animals, while the priests used only white. But all of this was taking me away from the immediate present. I was more concerned now about getting better and being able to move around again. After 3 days, it was thought better for me to get up and move around. My leg was very stiff and shockingly painful. The whole area was inflamed, and there was much discharge caused by the particles of iron rust which had not been removed. As I could not walk unaided, a crutch was made, and I hopped around on this with some resemblance to a wounded bird. My body still had a large number of burns and blisters from the hot ashes, but the whole lot together was not as painful as my leg. Sitting was impossible. I had to lie on my right side or on my face. Obviously, I could not attend services or the classrooms, so my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, taught me almost full time. He expressed himself as well satisfied with the amount I had learned in my few years, but said, "A lot of this you have unconsciously remembered from your last incarnation." End of chapter 5.